Mueller House Meeting, Monday morning, 7th April, 1975. Let us start this morning by recalling something which I said in connection with the word Atma at one of our previous meetings. When you yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, are the unresisting focus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendence, then that is the meaning of the word Atma. It is also the meaning of the phrase used in the Upanishads, realizing the Atma. You will see at once that this is the subjective, the personalistic way of expressing the fact of the one total reality. I always use the word transcendence, not in the sense of transcendence being something separate from this total reality. The total reality remains indefinable. When you yourself are in that state of utter purity, unresisting transcendence, then the total reality, infinite, is manifested through you, the person, the finite. And that is one of the meanings of Atma, as far as I can see. That is my own presentation of it. It is one of the meanings of Atma which perhaps the intellect can grasp with in the least misleading way. Now, yesterday and also before that, we spoke about the denudation of the mind as being characteristic of the process of utter purification. We saw that this denudation was a necessity if one is to realize in one's own being the supreme reality in supreme communion. We can look at this process of denudation in relation to the meaning of the word Atma, which I have suggested. You see, as every single obstructive idea, prejudice, preconception, or defilement of mind or heart is removed, what we commonly call our mind is being stripped clean. We can look at it in this way too, because as the final result of the complete stripping clean, there is the realization of Atma. Atma can be regarded as the eater up of the mind. The mind is eaten up by this transcendent reality. Now, this is an extraordinary thing to say. The individual psyche and what we commonly call my mind is simply the collection of all the passing thoughts and feelings, the mental fixations, distortions, perversions, and also the flashes of intuitive insight which compose it. All this, the mental process, the mental life process, is what we call mind. There is no such thing as mind in the sense that in the body there is a liver or a heart or a particular organism with a particular function. The psyche has no parts. It is the whole psyche which is seized with anger or filled with kindliness or love or whatever it is. The whole psyche operates at once. With the body, your hand or your foot or any other part of the body or the whole body in cooperation will work and perform its function. But with the psyche, the entire psyche does this, which simply means that all our psychical processes, all our mental activity, as we say, is just a name for something which is somewhat unknown to us, which takes place in the living organism. That is all we can say about it. Now, these mental processes and so forth, which keep our consciousness tied down to separate particulars, are the obstructions to that transcendent state in which man is at last perfect and true man. The true, perfect human, the happy creator. Until then, we are below that stage. We are subhuman, so to say. So now, in relinquishing all these mental obstructions to the emergence of the Supreme Reality, the Atma can be regarded as the eater-up of what we commonly call the mind. Now, let us briefly consider what is the source of ill, the source of evil in the world and in ourselves. Is it not essentially what we call the mind? It is perfectly true that the mind is intimately tied up with the body. No mind, no body. No body, no mind. The body is, so to say, as if it were the apparatus through which this phenomenon which we call mind manifests itself. Like an electric bulb is the apparatus through which light can manifest itself when electricity is flowing through it. Our life energy flowing through the organism, the body performs the part, perhaps, of the apparatus, and that which is made visible in our experience is the mind as a result of this life energy at work. Now, the source of ill is essentially in the mind, the world mind and in the individual mind equally. We all know that the mind is unskilled, it is impure, it is confused, it is self-involved, and that is its supreme flaw, its supreme difficulty. It is self-involved all the time, like a fly caught in a spider's web. And because it is self-involved, it functions in a manner which attempts to draw the world constantly to itself. There'd be nothing wrong in this if the mind were a perfect mind, perfectly enlightened, perfectly intelligent, perfectly capable. But is my mind perfectly enlightened, perfectly capable, perfectly intelligent? Not yet. And it may never be so during my lifetime. Now, when you get 4,000 million people in the world who are living, functioning in this manner with minds that are sick. The psyche is sick. What is the consequence? The consequence necessarily is that the world condition is a difficult one, a complicated one, an ill one, just like the individual mind is. Hence we see the prime necessity of dealing with the mind essentially, first and foremost, where living the religious life is concerned. And we can never emphasize too often that the religious life is not separate from the everyday secular life. If the secular life is pure, if it is intelligent, free of confusion, free above all of selfishness and self-orientation, then the everyday life is the perfect expression of the religious life. So now, having seen the necessity for the purification of mind, we will see that this purification means cleaning the mind out. We must understand clearly what this cleaning of the mind means. Let us first take an analogy. Supposing there is a room in a house which has not been attended to, and the result is there's a lot of dust and maybe cobwebs and a certain amount of dirt in that room. Now you can't take some wonderful substance called cleanness and sprinkle it all around. All you have to do is to get rid of the dirt. You take the dirt out, and then the room is clean. Now it's the same with the mind. The mind in itself essentially is the divine mind, is the universal mind. It is all my own flaws, the way I deal with what happens as it comes up within me, that makes the mind impure. It is my lack of insight, my fundamental ignorance that I am not separate from the world and the world is not separate from me. We are totally one. Whatsoever affects the world affects me. Whatsoever affects me affects the world. Whatsoever I do, think, say, feel, that is constantly affecting everybody around me. If we really appreciate that, we'll appreciate the curious, meticulous detail in which the moralities are presented in all the great religions. In thought and feeling, in speech and in action. All three. Everything has to be pure. Everything has to be virtuous. And we have to remain wide awake to that all through the day. So now, this denudation of the mind proceeds. This denudation is the essential characteristic of the search for ultimate reality. We say man seeks God. Man seeks to know what is ultimate reality, what is the purpose of our existence, the meaning of life, and so on. Now, the intellectual man, the philosopher, will try to discover this by looking outwards at the world, acquiring knowledge of the world, and then coming to certain conclusions. And he will present a system of thought a philosophy, a scientific treatise, or whatever it is. It must be remembered that all that the philosopher, the scientist, the practical man of the world, or anybody presents is the result of the functioning of the senses together with logical intellect. These two are at work. He does not take into account the fact that underlying it is the hidden basis within himself, namely his discriminative consciousness. And if you look deeply enough into anybody, into yourself, you will find that this discriminative consciousness functions all the time in terms of choosing any one finite thing at the expense of another finite thing. Your philosopher, your scientist, they all do the same thing. They select certain ideas, perceptions, and so forth, and they reject others. Now you see, when this happens, what happens to the one total reality in the consciousness of the philosopher or the scientist? It is no longer a one total reality. But the question he is asking, what is the ultimate reality? Now his discriminative consciousness prevents him, therefore, from realizing completely within himself the nature of this one total reality. And he never awakes to the fact that this is a matter which can never be perceived. It can never be seen as an object of knowledge. It can never be heard separately as an object of knowledge. And the same thing applies to the question, who am I? What am I? Your philosopher, your scientist, they try to answer that question in terms of discriminative consciousness and treating the question as if the I were an object which you yourself can look at. It cannot be done that way. This is where the religious men, the great founders of the religions, and all the perfected holy ones are different from philosopher, scientist, artist, practical man of the world, anybody and everybody. In making this inquiry, the holy ones, those who became the holy ones, started like anybody else, trying to look outwards to answer what is reality. And step by step they arrived at the statement, oh, it is not this, it is not that, it is not this, it is not that, and so on. And it was the same in trying to answer the question, who am I? But these men came across an extraordinary experience. In fact, many thousands of people come across this, but they don't take notice of it, sufficient notice of it. These men discovered that when, in the process of this inquiry, they happened to be in a quiet state inside themselves, when the sense functions were at peace, and they began to feel a sense of unity, a sense of communion with the world in which they lived, this separation due to discriminative consciousness of I, the person, and you, the object, vanished. In that state of unity, they discovered that all the turmoil of thought disappeared. And in the disappearance of that turmoil of thought, with the body completely awake, remember, not fallen asleep. This is the important point. They saw that here was a way of undergoing a transformation of their mode of awareness itself, their fundamental mode of awareness of existence, which brought forth an experience, a living experience of the actual reality. And they also discovered that as this state intensified, it could not be put into a system of ideas or thoughts, because they are all confined to particulars, nor could they find any words in the language fully to express it. No words can express this. You know, one of the great Christian mystics, I believe it was Erigena, I'm not quite sure, but he belongs, I think, to the first, that's it, he belongs to the first 1,000 years of Christian mysticism. He said, it would be much easier and truer to say what God is not than to try to say what God is. And these men, through the ages, at least from 6,000 years ago, realized this extraordinary condition of stillness and peace. Now note carefully that in this state the denudation of the mind is complete. It gets empty of all the preconceptions and the ideas. The process of thinking stops, altogether stops, but you are fully awake. In the normal way, when you are awake, the process of thinking never stops. You can't stop it. You try and see. It will go on perpetually. But they discovered that the process of thinking stops. And the primary scientific meaning of the of meditation and the state of meditation is that the thinking process, which is the talking process, has completely stopped. But you are fully awake, and you are actually experiencing complete unity with the total environment. It is only afterwards, when you come out of that state and the thinking process starts up again, that you might be able, if you have sufficient gift to do so, to talk about it and try and express it in language which is the least misleading language. You know how Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras starts off with the statement, Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga is the fading away, the ending of all thought process, of all the transform, the different limited shapes that the mind takes. When the process of taking limited shapes by the mind is over, the mind which we call our mind is no longer our mind, but is the universal mind operating through an empty psyche. Empty of all evil, remember. Everything that obstructs. This is the great thing. And you'll find that this lies at the heart of all the great mystical or religious or yogic or other similar disciplines of the world. And it's the identical discipline which has come down through the centuries, through the millennia. So you see, what has happened is that everything that is unessential is out, is removed. All the dirt is removed out of the room, and the room is clean. The mind and the heart are clean in that empty state. But that emptiness cannot be realized unless there is the preliminary basis through years and years of gentle, careful discipline by which purity of mind and heart has been established. You may ask, well, what is the test for this? The test is very simple. As you go through the day, watch the reactions in your own mind. When something is said or done, or you hear some news or whatever it is, or some event takes place, how does the mind react? Does it rise up in anger? Does it rise up in fear? Does it rise up in greed or jealousy or hate, etc., etc.? There's the test. You will know then whether the mind and heart within this living organism is pure or not. That is the simple test. Now, he who can do that is the natural teacher for those around him. He who cannot do that can only give verbal information. Anybody can give verbal information. You know the famous statement we have in English, the devil quotes scripture. Well, of course, it's the finest thing to quote. It deceives everybody. You see? But the person whose mind and heart is pure will never react. Naturally and spontaneously, never react in terms of violence, greed, fear, or any such thing. The ill state is out. That is the simple test. So now we come to this business of the experiencing of the ultimate reality. I suggested the two questions, which are the fundamental questions that man has asked through the ages. What is reality? Who am I? Sometimes, instead of asking what is reality, which is the physical form, the very religious-minded devotee would ask, what is God? Who is God? And who am I? And what is our relationship? Now, consider carefully. The Holy One, exploring this question outwardly, objectively, starts, of course, with sense observation and logical intellect, and all this quietens down, the mind gets emptied, and he reaches that state of utter emptiness inside. Emptiness of all the influences that make him conscious in terms of the finite and the separate, the particular thing, that which begins, proceeds, and dies. In other words, in terms of mortality, the sphere of mortality over which the Lord of Death is supreme. When that quietens down, he reaches that final condition of utter unity, then on coming back from that state of unitary wholeness of awareness, the analytical process starts again, and the universe gets split up in forms of thought and speech which are intended to represent the workings of transcendent energy in its various outstanding forms. And it is these various outstanding forms of the workings of transcendent energy which he names as the different archangels and angels and so on, and also the destructive powers. That is to say, not so much destructive powers as the powers, these powers of transcendent energy which transform the particular way in which there has been expression in the universe in order to make way for a new form. Because every old form must of necessity be discarded, and a new form has to take its place. It's the same with us in the world, in the animal world of creatures and humans. A new body comes into being, it's born, it grows, it procreates, it comes to the end of its life, and it dies. And the new forms keep coming. This rhythm of life goes on and on like that. So when the Holy One comes back from that primordial condition, the analytical process starts up again, and he creates these fundamental forms. Take, for instance, as an analogy which might be helpful, what the scientist does. Fundamental energy is the unknown. We don't know what ultimate energy is. We know its secondary manifestations only, its variations, electricity, magnetism, gravitational energy, chemical energy, mechanical energy, light energy. You see, the different forms of energy which the scientist knows. In the same way, there are these different forms in which this primordial, mysterious, unknown and unknowable mind energy, the divine mind at work, is named by as so many archangels, angels, and the demons and the powers which dissolve the old form in order that the new may come into being. Now, this ultimate state in India, they named Brahman. Brahman. Answering the question, what is reality? And they asked the question, who am I? And to their surprise, they discovered that they ended up in the same state of ultimate awareness of existence. And the process, after the preliminary start in terms of ordinary thinking, analytical thinking, the middle stage was the great process of denudation, and the ultimate stage was this transcendent awareness of existence as unitary wholeness. And because in this case they were more sort of aware of the eating up of the mind, all the thought forms in the mind which we associate with ourselves. We say, oh, that is me. I am this, that and the other in quality and in nature. I think like this, I feel like this, I see the world like that, and so forth. Because that was all eaten up, they said, this is the state of Atma. The same state, mind you, it is the same as the state of Brahman. They called it Atma. Now, I like to put it, personally, I like to put it this way. Supposing Brahman, the one total reality, were to say the word, I am, then that is the subjective expression of the objective fact of Brahman. And this subjective expression is the same as saying Atma. Brahman saying, I am, is the meaning of Atma. You yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, not resisting the inflow and outflow of the transcendent reality, are Atma. Now you see why two words were used for the same experience, the same ultimate result. It has never been explained in the Upanishads, or by Shankara, or by any of the great philosophers, in this way. I don't know why they never sort of saw it. It's so simple, really. When you look into the process that takes place in your own mind, you see why the two different names are there, Brahman and Atma. Now, this denudation process, the denudation of the mind, the cleaning out of this temple in order that the Holy Spirit may manifest unhindered. This cleaning out cannot be done and must never attempted to be done forcibly. Never say, out, devil, out. If you say, out, devil, out, you will embrace each other more heartily than ever. No. Look at this devil. Who is he? Myself. I can't kick myself out. Impossible. That is myself. Functioning in the way which resists the perfect, the transcendent, God. That's what it means. Obstructs God. So, we come back again to the golden key. As Jesus said, watch and pray. As the Buddha said, perfect mindfulness and perfect communion. Samasati, samasamadhi. Watch carefully. This energy which is liberated in this utterly dispassionate watching, without exercising any choice in favor of this or against that. But this pure watching is the power, is the real energy which utterly purifies the mind, the psyche, and heals the illness of the psyche. Then the soul is totally and utterly healed. To use the terms which we used yesterday when we were considering the meaning of Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? The meaning of Eloi, the vital principle within one, the intellectual principle which flowers out in unerring insight, which is the true meaning of buddhi, and the essence of transcendence itself, the neshama, they are all a unified whole, a completely unified whole. That is the meaning of Eloi. We saw that yesterday. Now, when this Eloi is realized, this unified mind state comes into being, and this is the real meaning of the word ekagrata, as used in connection with yoga and with the meditation practices. The ekagrata state is realized, which does not mean so much the one-pointed. One-pointed is not a very good translation. It is there, of course, up to a point, but it means the completely unified mind, made whole and perfect. When that stage is realized, then you know the meaning of the silence. We think of the silence as meaning the absence of noise, the absence of sound. That isn't the case at all. The transcendent silence holds all the opposites that we experience and feel. Noise and the absence of noise, which we call silence. But this real silence includes everything. Totally includes everything as part and parcel of it. In the last few days, we were talking about this in a different way. We know how the whole universe has vast empty distances, as we call them, and only a particle here, a galaxy there. But that which has no particle, no particular finite something in the way, is the real nature of the universe. And its immensity completely eats up, like Atma eats up all the different states of mind and so forth, you see, eats up all that is particular and limited and finite. And this is all held within this transcendent reality. It's as if the divine just thought, I think I shall just restrict myself a little bit and give that nice man there a chance to see me. It's as if that sort of thing happened. You see? So this silence which you realize is a silence in which all the noise of the world is resolved into an extraordinary harmony. Now it is very hard to see this in the ordinary way or to believe it. And I'm not asking you to believe it. You can experience something for yourself. Take some piece of music which you find terribly noisy, very harsh, discordant and awful. Now, turn it on the gramophone in the room, loud, and you will feel, oh, how dreadful this is. And you say, turn it off. No, don't turn it off. Turn the volume down and down and down until there comes the point when you will absorb it quite easily. It will be part and parcel of you. You won't reject it. It's an extraordinary thing. Supposing you see there is a picture and it has colors which you might say, oh, awful clashing colors. But let those colors be in nature side by side and with that enormous background, you will find that the colors are quite acceptable. And it is like that when you enter this inner state of consciousness, the clamor and the noise and the disharmony of the surface layer of the psyche and the mind has resolved itself into a harmony contained within this supreme whole. And that is the test, that is the proof that you have entered that state of silence. And in that state of silence, you see with the eyes of God, not with the eyes of man, the whole universe flowing past in peace and in harmony. Then you can understand Browning's words, the poet, English poet Robert Browning. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. See what extraordinary depth there is in the words of a poet. And this is the sort of silence that one experiences, in which all the sound, whether pleasant or unpleasant, of the world is subsumed. Now, this subsiding of the turmoil in our own minds and psyche, which is fundamentally due, remember, not only to our mental reactions to all the stimuli that come to us, but to the fact that we are basically conscious in terms of separation, of discriminative consciousness. We separate this from that, we choose this and reject that. That is the flaw. You see? Now, when all this turmoil subsides, this is the most critical stage in meditation. Because once that has become perfectly peaceful, and you are fully awake, you are more awake than ever, you are far more intensely sensitive than ever, in that state you open the doors of deathlessness. The deathlessness which is not mere continuity. This deathlessness, this experiencing of immortality, and I can tell you this is quite true, this experiencing of immortality is present because you are totally attentive, you are totally conscious of the immediate now, and that never has an ending or a beginning in terms of a movement from one state to another. We say we move in the ordinary consciousness, that we move from one state to another. That is because we undergo birth, procedure and death in any one state, and then we move on to another. But if there is total attentiveness to the immediate now, it is that immediate now which is perpetually transforming into what ordinarily we say is another state. Therefore, here there is no another state, but the absolute transforming process only, free of time consciousness. The limitations of time consciousness. In other words, time has given place to eternity. And so, here and now, in this total attentiveness, you are actually living immortally. And that is the only meaning of immortality. One last word. You remember we looked into this matter a few days ago, that the body has been rather despised in the religious writings of the past. This is a great mistake. The body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. There is nothing to despise in it. And all the great teachers have always warned against the senses. Beware of your senses. They will tempt you. They will seduce you. They will drag you down. But look, enter this state of peace and purity inside yourself. It will come to you naturally, and especially in a valley like this. You have a God-given gift here. It will come to you sweetly and naturally. And then you will discover that when you look, when you listen, as you breathe, as you touch the stones or the trees or anything at all, your senses are the living cords of communion with the transcendent reality. This is the real meaning, the ultimate meaning of happiness, here now in its most concrete form in this world.